You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, baseball legend Hank Aaron has passed away. We'll look back at his life and career and find out why Milwaukee wasn't his only Wisconsin connection. Now, when President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris took office this week, they inherited a pair of connected crises of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and a troubled economy and job market. The U.S. Labor Department released its latest unemployment numbers yesterday, a decrease from the previous week, but still at high levels. Last week, Biden unveiled an ambitious nearly $2 trillion plan to combat these crises. As he's said numerous times, fixing the economy means beating the coronavirus.
This will be one of the most challenging operational efforts we have ever undertaken as a nation. We'll have to move heaven and earth to get more people vaccinated, to create more places for them to get vaccinated, to mobilize more medical teams to get shots in people's arms, to increase vaccine supply, and to get it out the door as fast as possible.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Biden's recovery and relief proposals so far? What changes would you like to see made in order for it to come into effect? What do you think the economy needs? What, if anything, do you want to see coming from Congress in the weeks to come? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And what would help you most of all in your work, in your need for work, in your business? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Catherine Willoughby is the Golombievsky Professor of Public Administration at the University of Georgia School of Public and International Affairs. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, as we heard from the president, I've been hearing from economists since, I don't know, as long ago as April. I've heard a lot of people make the case we don't solve the economy unless we solve the pandemic. Do you agree with that basic notion?
Sure, that's true. And we're finally at the point now where we've got a national strategy being mapped out that will provide us a way forward. And significantly, it's recognized as, in fact, a true disaster. And Biden has stipulated that it's a war on coronavirus. And this is very necessary and needed.
Now, unemployment is still higher than it was pre-pandemic. It's not as high as it was during some of the initial shutdowns back in April and May. What are your worries for maybe those people who are still unemployed in a long-term unemployed state right now?
Yeah, it's a real problem, and it's quite significant. I think it was upwards of closing in on 15% around April of 2020, and now it's down nationwide under 7%, I believe. But it's, you know, at 10%, for instance, for African Americans. And so for various groups, it's quite high and shocking, and is typical of a disaster that can shake out true inequities. I think going forward, we definitely need the push to get schools open. Once we get schools open, then parents can return to work full time and uninterrupted. So the push to open schools, to attack the virus, are really appropriate to boost economic activity and to get people working again.
Now, a $1.9 trillion price tag. We've heard some people in Congress looking at that and saying, well, we've already had a couple real big budget busters coming out with relief packages so far, worried about the impacts of the debt growing over the years. Are you worried about deficit increases, debt increases, or is the need urgent enough to risk it?
Well, of course, somebody like me would remain deeply concerned about rising debt and deficits and tremendous ones at this point. But we have to remember that a one-time fix in this case is not going to work. People are going to need support as this virus continues. Businesses, you know, the operations around the nation are eclectic, meaning, you know, some states open businesses back up and then they have to close them back down. These kinds of activities keep people from making true progress. So it's going to be a concerted effort at this point. I'm encouraged by the centralizing national strategy that we have that can attack this war on the virus in a more centralized way and help with differences across the nation, given our truly intergovernmental system in which the federal government certainly operates, but states and localities operate according to their own tune in many cases.
We're talking to Catherine Willoughby, professor of public administration at the University of Georgia, looking at the dual challenges, pandemic recovery, economic recovery from the damage from the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like what you're seeing from the new president so far? What do you want to see get passed by Congress? What would help you the most? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Josh is with us in Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I do like where the administration is going. However, I do think that if we are going to do another stimulus check for individuals, number one, it needs to be the last one because you have to go back to work. But in the long run, like your speaker was stating, I do think that maybe down the road, one until COVID is licked, perhaps businesses are where the stimulus checks need to be going after perhaps one more individual one, because as people go back to work and these businesses may or may not need another stimulus, that is where we are getting our pay from. That is where, like I said, people need to get back to work. If those businesses can't maintain, it doesn't matter how many handouts you're given.
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Josh points us toward three different things that have been in past recovery packages. You know, stimulus checks to lots of different people, enhanced unemployment benefits to the unemployed, and then things like the Paycheck Protection Program helping some of those hardest hit businesses. Is one of those for you, Catherine, a priority in a potential next recovery act?
Well, I think the caller made great points, and that's the conundrum here is we've got a debilitating virus that is affecting the economy and everything about it, and explosive, you know, federal spending. He's correct. We can't keep doing this, but right now we've got to develop this national policy. We've got to help people be able to eat food and keep a roof over their head. We've got to get schools open. I'm not sure people realize, but I hope I'm wrong, but we've probably lost a whole generation of young people who have essentially dropped out of the education system wherever they live. And this is a real problem that we are going to have to deal with. So we've got to keep people being able to, live. And then he's right. We've got to get businesses to be able to be open and stay open to keep people working.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Dennis now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Catherine. If I recall correctly from a previous guest, like a month or before the previous stimulus package, either the government did or could create money or instead of borrowing money. I'm just wondering if you could clarify that for me. Thank you.
Dennis, thanks. I think he's referring to a conversation about it's called MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, but the idea of printing more money by government fiat, in effect, Catherine, versus actually borrowing it, issuing bonds and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's not ideal for sure, and we want to be able to move through this without just printing money and devaluing the dollar. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Catherine Willoughby from the University of Georgia, looking at President Biden's goals in reviving the American economy, in part by tackling the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there things you've seen from the new president that sound like good ideas to you? Are there things that you think are unnecessary or you're worried about? What would help you, whatever your economic state is right now, deal with tough times or maybe uncertainty? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with Catherine Willoughby, professor of public administration at the University of Georgia, looking at what it would take to help fix the economy. A big part of it is solving the pandemic problem, she says. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress, from the Biden administration? Back to your calls now. Arnold is with us in Campbellsport. Arnold, hello.
Yeah. I fired since Roosevelt. Milk Cow was under Roosevelt, so I'm not a young man any longer. And I farmed it, and I understand the farm question quite well. When we had parity, that's the concept of getting paid on the cost of production, and that worked under Roosevelt. We got from 1935 to 1955, we got a 98.8 percentage point on parity. Now, that was good. And under Nixon and Johnson, we went down a little. We went down to 70%. Carter, he held it at 80%.
I'm going to jump in, Arnold, because we don't have too much time left, but I think I see the problem you're pointing to. We've had problems, Catherine, with losing small, even mid-sized dairy farms in Wisconsin and elsewhere in recent years. Pandemic disrupted some demand at schools and elsewhere. Is the farm sector something you look at?
Not specifically, but it's right in there with all the problems that we have today. You're exactly right. I mean, we need farmers. We need to, and we need to be concerned about all the different kinds of livelihoods. So, yeah, the interests of farmers should be right front and center with everything else. That's the problem. There's everything else. But that's, you know, our farming communities are the heart of our existence here in the United States.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Catherine, I want to bring in another part of relief efforts that people have talked about, and that's state, local governments and direct funding, maybe relief funding. They're getting hit by a lack of revenue because of the economic downturn. People making the case for it on that basis. Some Republicans saying, in effect, that's going to bail out states that did a poor job of managing their finances before the pandemic. What are your thoughts on that possibility of federal relief for local government units?
I think it's appropriate and it's needed. I think state and local governments have been obviously hit. Localities, particularly small local governments, are hit very hard by the pandemic. And I think this is necessary money that needs to come down and support the efforts of governments to support their Main Street businesses and the health care work that's going on and supporting the health care infrastructures in their communities and across the state. So I think this is well spent.
Let's go back to our callers now. Marlene is with us in Milwaukee. Marlene, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. One of my concerns is with the long-term health effects of COVID on our young people. Right now, we don't understand this virus. There is such a huge push to get kids back in school, and in particular at the high school age, a lot of kids are learning online, and when they go back into the classroom, there are not many districts that have teachers to teach online, and then the kids are in the classroom, and you have a separate teacher teaching. So what you end up with is the kids going into the classroom, being exposed to more people, but sitting at a desk with their computer and doing the same thing they would be doing if they were at home. this is a war, and if you knew that these viruses, if they were terrorists attacking people, you would have a better idea of what the long-term effects would be. But I know studies have shown that 15% of the college athletes who get COVID have heart damage. So I'm really concerned for the long that we're missing the boat on worrying about the long-term effects on our students.
Marlene, thanks for the call. And that move to get kids back into schools, there's hope that if we can get the teachers and staff vaccinated, that's going to be enough. Marlene, Catherine, not still worried about the impacts on the kids?
Sure, absolutely. And that is why we have a push to get teachers vaccinated and to continue to provide schools with resources to be able to keep their schools clean and advance getting young people back into distanced, you know, social distancing while learning, wearing their masks, being careful. But online learning is extremely difficult, and it's difficult for particular groups of kids. It's very difficult to bring in kids who have little support at home. There are, as we know, areas around the United States that don't have internet connection, and it's very difficult. So there's a lot of concerns about extended online learning for young people and for children.
Thanks for the call, Marlene. We're talking about economic recovery and pandemic recovery with Catherine Willoughby from the University of Georgia School of Public and International Affairs, and with you at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Jay is on the line calling from DeForest. Jay, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I kind of just want to comment on the stimulus checks that many of us received the past year and might receive in the future. I think those could be better directed. My wife and I were fortunate enough to keep our jobs, and we're working from home. And we got these checks that we really didn't need. I mean, we're spending less money than we ever have because we're not going anywhere. And, you know, we might eventually put these checks into the economy somehow, but it's not going to be in our normal. It's not going to be in the way we would have, because anywhere we would have spent the money, the bars and restaurants are closed. So... you know,
Jay,
I don't know. I think that might be very
thanks
directed.
A lot for the call. So better directed stimulus Jay's looking for, Catherine.
Yeah, I think that is, you know, it is always a problem with government programs. Let's be honest, that they're going to cover some folks that, you know, they're like, why am I getting this? On the other hand, and that caller mentioned the fact that people are saving their money more than ever before. So it's not necessarily being fed directly back into the economy. And, you know, with time and learning, we can coalesce to provide programs like this to, you know, smaller gaps of folks, for instance. So I think the caller has a valid statement about any kind of government program that probably, you know, covers some folks that may not exactly need the help.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Kathy now in Spooner. Kathy, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Kathy?
What I wanted to say was I've talked to a lot of people who don't understand about the vaccine, and they don't want to get it. So I tell them, you need to look at the CDC website. You need to educate yourself as much as possible so that you get vaccinated. I feel that the more people that get vaccinated, it'll stimulate the economy, get people back to work, open more businesses, if people understand more about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I think also, too, if Congress would just work with the president and so that he can get what he wants, so that people can get back to work and push for this vaccine. I just believe that the more people are educated about it, the better off we're going to be.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Catherine?
Yeah, that's such a great bunch of information right there, and points to this benefit of having a new administration come in and make this the focus of getting us up and running again. We have to get the information out to people. We have to have a leader nationwide who says it's very important to keep up all these practices, and it's very important for us to get this vaccine out to everybody as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So, you know, already I can tell that the new administration and Biden is having an impact in getting people to understand the importance of vaccinations and combating this virus that is deeply dangerous.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Catherine, in our last few moments, there are some of these things that the Biden administration can do on its own, but there's a lot they can't do without Congress. Are you optimistic that we'll see bipartisan cooperation on at least some of the priorities we've been talking about?
You know, I am, and I'm optimistic because Biden and the vice president have both been in Congress and longstanding. Certainly, Joe Biden is longstanding in his congressional career. And so I am going to be optimistic that we are in a new era and we are going to take this seriously. We've got an administration who is providing direction and hope and strategies for us to all work together, an intergovernmental system that is really going to all be looking in the same direction. So I am pretty optimistic. It won't be for everything, but I do see that we will probably be successful in a number of ventures, and I believe we are going to get to the end of this pandemic.
Catherine, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Take care.
You too. Catherine Willoughby is a professor of public administration at the University of Georgia. We talked to her today about President Biden's proposals to rescue the nation's economy and defeat the pandemic. Coming up, we'll look at the life and career of baseball legend Hank Aaron and find out why Milwaukee wasn't his only Wisconsin connection. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been a boom in rental housing construction around the United States for single-family houses. We'll find out what's driving it and what it can mean for housing costs in the future. Now we'll take a look at the life and career of one of baseball's all-time greats. Hank Aaron, a Milwaukee legend famed for breaking Babe Ruth's home run record, has died at age 86. After starting his career in the Negro Leagues, Aaron spent most of his remarkable career with the Milwaukee and then Atlanta Braves. As Aaron pursued his 715th home run in 1974, surpassing Ruth's record 714, he received hate mail, death threats, and threats that his children would be kidnapped. Eventually, Aaron went on to rack up a grand total of 755 home runs in his decades-long career. He was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1982. His number one records for total bases and runs batted in have yet to be broken. Still holds the record number two for at-bats and number three for hits. Aaron's best known in Wisconsin for his time with the Milwaukee Braves and for ending his career with the Brewers. Our guest today shares the story of a lesser-known chapter in his Wisconsin career in Eau Claire. Jerome Poling is the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. He's a marketing communications manager at UW-Stout. Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
One of the great legendary players, what drew you, Jerry, to Hank Aaron and his story?
Well, I knew for many years that there was a story of Hank playing that one summer in Eau Claire, and I'd heard a lot of things about that summer for many years, you know, good or bad, what actually took place when he played here that year. And to me, it was compelling because you have this young man from Mobile, Alabama, growing up with the Jim Crow laws down there, starting his career that spring in the Negro Leagues, and then being dropped in a place like Eau Claire, which was extremely white. He had never played with white baseball players before, had never been really lived in a white city. And suddenly he's dropped into this place in Eau Claire, northern Wisconsin, and he's got to figure out how to, you know, not only play baseball at the major minor league professional level for the first time, but also to live on his own for the first time in a place that was probably pretty foreign to him. So I thought it was a compelling story to try and, you know, get to the bottom of what took place that summer and how it affected the rest of his life.
To top it off, Jerry, as I understand it, he's 19 when this Alabama kid comes to Eau Claire?
Yeah, he's 18, actually.
18.
Yeah, and if you saw a picture of him in his uniform, he looked like he, you know, had been away from home for about 4 months, which he was. He was about 150 pounds and, you know, just not fully filled out as the Hank Aaron we remember playing for the Braves and the Brewers. He was kind of a skinny kid. was supposed to play shortstop and, you know, I actually had been batting cross-handed like a month before he came to Eau Claire. Nobody really taught him the fundamentals of baseball. He had to learn it on his own. He just was a natural talent who kept getting better and better by learning the game.
Now, here he is. He's going to play for the Eau Claire Bears. Tell us a bit about the team.
Eau Claire had its first, of course, you look back at 1947, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. Eau Claire had his first black player in this minor league team in 1950, so it had another black player in 51. The 52 team had three black players, one of them being Hank. But he was accepted quite well in the team. But really, when he got to Eau Claire, it was a challenge for him personally because of this environment that he was in that he was just not used to. And again, he was facing a white pitcher for the first time in his life. And, you know, growing up with Jim Crow laws, you know, what's your perception of that, that the white race is better? And, you know, so he had to overcome a lot of these fears and prove to himself that he could not only survive on the baseball field with white players and against white players, but at the same time, you know, make it in this city that was, again, kind of foreign to him. And he admits that it was his first few weeks he felt quite alone and quite out of place. But once he settled in, I really think it became a seminal summer in his life. I believe that, and Hank Aaron said this when he came to Eau Claire in 1994 to unveil a statue of him, that if it wasn't for Eau Claire, he wasn't sure what would have happened to him in his baseball career. Because he had such a good experience here by the time he left, not only as a player but as a person, that by the end he left here with an awful lot of confidence that he could make it not only on the field but off the field as well and handle what was going to come his way no matter what it was. But he had a good experience. You know, people treated him fairly and respectfully in Eau Claire, and I think, you know, Eau Claire residents still today take a lot of pride in that they helped launch the career of one of the great baseball and great athletic icons in our history.
Talk about Jerome Poling. He's the author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. We're talking about Hank Aaron, who passed away this morning, legendary Milwaukee Brave, Atlanta Brave, Milwaukee Brewer player. All right, so Jerry, this is a guy who's going to go on to break the Major League Baseball home run record, still holds a lot of the records out there, also batted lifetime over 300, not too shabby for a home run hitter. Were there signs when he was playing for the Eau Claire Bears that, hey, this is a talent?
Definitely. There were reports that when he got to Eau Claire that he had this natural hitting ability, that he was just an outstanding hitter. And the coaches in Eau Claire, interestingly enough, his head coach in Eau Claire was from Mobile, Alabama, his same hometown, but he didn't know him, of course. But there were signs that he was going to be a great hitter, and the coaches in Eau Claire were told to not mess with his swing, just let him do what he did naturally, because he hit off the back foot, had powerful wrists, and snapped his wrists through the ball kind of late. So he was a great contact hitter. He had that extra split second of being able to snap those wrists through that other players didn't have, and so he would get a little better look at the ball. So he had 336 that year, didn't strike out a lot, which was actually one of the hallmarks of Hank Aaron's hitting career. He didn't strike out a lot, and you don't hear that a lot with home run hitters. In Eau Claire, he only hit 9 home runs, but that was partly because he was still learning the game a little bit, I believe, and also, again, he only weighed about 150 pounds at that time. But he made the All-Star team and was Rookie of the Year in the Northern League that year. So, yeah, he left Eau Claire, I think, every bit the player that at that time the Boston Braves thought he would be.
And he left Eau Claire. He didn't stick around too long, but for good reasons. He kept moving up through the minor league system and ultimately to the majors to meet those Boston Braves when they came to Milwaukee. Can you talk about his progression out of Eau Claire?
Yeah, so one summer in Eau Claire, and then the very next year he goes to Jacksonville of the Southern Atlantic League, and actually had to break the color barrier there with several teammates and endured a much more difficult year there because he was a subject of overt racism throughout that season. It was much more difficult, but had an even better year in Jacksonville in 1953, and then he was invited to the Milwaukee Braves training camp to start 1954. And I don't remember the exact scenario, but I believe someone got hurt, maybe Bobby Thompson. And Aaron yes. was put into the outfield to start the season and never looked back. So, you know, 2 years after playing in Eau Claire, he was starring for the Milwaukee Braves. And as we all know, 1957, he led the Braves to the World Series championship, hitting three home runs and batting almost 400 for that series. So, I mean, he was well on his way at that point to being one of the great players of all time.
And Jerry, he split his career, a lot of it in Wisconsin, obviously with Milwaukee, the two different Milwaukee teams, a lot of it in Atlanta. You mentioned he came back for that dedication in Eau Claire. I hear stories of him being here for the dedication of the Hank Aaron Trail and other events. It sounds like, if I have it right, he felt that connection with Wisconsin, even though he didn't play his whole career here.
Yeah, no question. I've heard him interviewed many times on radio talk shows and various things, and he always spoke highly of Wisconsin. I think he just felt like that was his second home. And he would also make a point of mentioning Eau Claire when people would say, hey, you started your career in Milwaukee, and he'd say, no, I actually started my career in Eau Claire. You know, and he remembered that. He appreciated the respect and the treatment he got from people here. He made friends here with some people that he kept up with many, many years later, you know, because he remembered the kindness that people showed him in Eau Claire. And I think he knows that, you know, he could have been like many other young ball players at that time who were frightened off by racism or frightened off by loneliness or just being too far from home when you're 18 and just go home because you can't handle it. And, you know, people, I think, kind of welcomed him and made him feel at home here. And I don't think he ever forgot that.
Jerry, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jerry Poling, author of A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron and the Legend of Eau Claire Baseball. He's a marketing communications manager at UW-Stout. He shared with us that chapter in Hank Aaron's early career here in Wisconsin. Hank Aaron passed away this morning. Coming up, investors are buying up land around the country to build houses, not to sell, but to rent. We talked to a Wall Street Journal reporter about the trend and learned about the rental housing market, even here in the Midwest. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Russia jails its fiercest critic, and two nuclear neighbors are brought closer by an amazing game of cricket. All that and more on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the coronavirus pandemic has increased demand for homes in suburban areas. As more folks work from home, they need space for offices, desks, and families. With housing prices rising faster than wages, many are renting those homes. Our next guest says the demand for rental houses existed before the pandemic, and there's been a big investment in the construction of single-family homes, not to own, but to rent. Ryan Diesemer is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's been covering the boom in the rental housing market. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write, Ryan, this trend, houses being built with the intention of being rented, it goes back before the pandemic. Where is this market coming from?
Well, it all started, you know, in the foreclosure crisis of the last decade when all those foreclosed homes hit the market. Investors bought a lot of them and some really big investors, big Wall Street financiers bought them, fixed them up, turned them into, you know, rental homes and built these big single family rental companies, something that didn't exist before. Renting homes was always sort of a local mom and pop business. Those businesses became so lucrative that they decided, well, you know, we don't have to just buy them at, you know, 40 cents on the dollar in a foreclosure auction. We can buy houses off the market. Now, of course, we know that home prices since then have risen. Competition for those houses is fierce. And so some of these investors have said, well, you know what? Why don't we just build the houses to rent straight away? You know, doing that allows them to basically design a home that's intended to be rent constructed that right from the start, so they can think about finishes and making homes durable for multiple tenants. What these landlords have also found is that people are willing to pay a premium to be the first people to move into a house. It's not that different than, you know, if you went out and were looking to buy a house, you might pay a little more to be the first person to own a home.
This is a big switch, though, right? I mean, because I think you think rental, you think multi-unit, apartment building, right, or even a duplex or townhouses or something like that. This whole concept of renting a single-family house versus buying it has not really been the norm, has it?
Yeah, well, so, you know, renting homes is an ancient business, frankly. But what sort of is new is sort of who's renting. Now, you know, the financial crisis also... some other things happened, right? You had a tremendous, you had people unable to tap into their home equity because home prices fell. So that contributed to the huge rise in student debt that we have. You know, we went from like, say under $500 billion of student debt before the housing crash. Now we've got like $1.7 trillion and rising, right? So all these young people that are graduating college, they've got pretty good jobs, they earn a lot, but they have a lot of debt, usually student debt. And that's keeping them from buying homes, but it's not keeping them from doing things like getting married and having children and doing these things that sort of compel people to move into the suburban home. So they've sort of, they're this ideal market. They can pay a lot of rent and they want to live there, but they might not have the means to buy a house, usually the down payment. And of course, a lot of people sort of psychologically are scarred from the crash. They might've gone through it and lost a home or been stuck in an underwater house for years. They may have seen their parents or friends go through foreclosure. So, you know, buying a home for a lot of people lost its luster. And there's also a fraction of people that, you know, they see home prices rising and they say, well, they're going to stop rising at some point or they're going to fall. So maybe you have people waiting. You also have a lot of people, you know, there's not a lot of Americans that get that job right out of college, move to a town and stay there their whole career. People move around a lot now for work. So you have this huge number of people, sort of the millennial generation, that are what you'd consider a homeowner, you'd think would be a typical American homeowner before, who are still rentals or renters. One stat that really jumps out is that, you know, in 2006, before the home prices crashed, the number of people that earned a six-figure income that rented was about 12%. Of renters had a six-figure income. And when you adjust that for inflation and compare it to today, we're at like 19 or 20% of six-figure earners that are renting their homes. And the big rise is, you know, that equates to like more than 3 million Americans. And the big rise, you know, you'd think it'd be New York and Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and these high-priced markets. And that's true. There's a lot of high-earning renters in those cities. But the explosion in the numbers we've seen is like really in middle America, places like Cincinnati, Denver, Houston, San Antonio, places like that. And so these investors are really gunning for that market, the high earning person who can't or doesn't want to buy a house.
And then sticking with geography, where is this happening? Close to city centers, suburbs, a mix of both?
It's mostly, you know, It's a lot of the Sun Belt, you know, the sort of sprawling, the Phoenix and Houstons of the world where you can sort of build out to the horizon and you have these booming cities. That's where a lot of the big investors go because they want to put a lot of money to work. You know, they think in hundreds of millions and billions, you know, they're not doing a few houses here and there. Now, in Wisconsin and other place markets around the Great Lakes, the real big boom is among smaller investors, and they're not necessarily building a lot of houses for rent. They may be doing one-offs, but the big play in those markets is to buy old houses, often in the cities, fix them up, and then flip them to somebody who will own them as a rental home. Cleveland, Ohio, South Bend, Indiana, Pittsburgh, these are some of the most profitable places that have been, at least in recent years, to buy an old house, you know, buy that 100-year-old house, fix it up and turn it into a rental for some, you know, recent graduate to move in and live in the city. That's sort of the big play that we're seeing around the Great Lakes.
Talking to Ryan Diesember, reporter for the Wall Street Journal, looking at the rise of the rental housing market, single family homes being bought for rental purposes or being built for rental purposes. Now, Ryan, part of what's driving this is, okay, if I'm that home buyer, there's nothing I can afford. Maybe there's limited stock of houses for sale. Well, now hold on. If these renting companies are buying up the housing stock, the new houses being built are being built to rent. If I want to buy a house, the market's getting cleared out even more. It's going to get me even harder for me to find that house. Is there something to that?
Yeah, you know, in recent years, especially like, say, between the pandemic and, you know, the worst of the housing crash. So, you know, out of the depths of the housing crash, say 2014 until, you know, maybe last year, that was sort of the play. You know, a house hits the open market, the Wall Street rental firms, the big firms, they have, you know, very sophisticated computers, networks of brokers and house hunters. These computers will, you know, they'll ping on a house the moment it hits the MLS, if it the listing service, if it checks all their boxes of, you know, the market they want to be in, the type of house they want. They love newer houses. They want to be in like the best school districts. They don't want a too big of a house. They don't want too big of a property. They like that sort of cookie cutter house because they know what to expect when they buy it. They know what to expect when their repairs pop up, and they're very sort of homogenous. Now, there was a lot of competition for homes. The Wall Street firms will usually win when they're up against, a first-time home buyer. And the reason isn't that they're willing to offer more money. They usually offer the same amount, but they can pay cash. They don't fuss over the carpet or the paint like you and I would. There's no emotion attached. You know, they write an offer and they'll pay all cash tomorrow or next month if you want. So for a seller, they're like sort of the perfect buyer. So they'll end up winning a lot of those. Now, where they started to build houses is because, you know, you can only accumulate so many houses that way. You know, it takes a lot of time. You're buying them one at a time and individual transactions. We all know how difficult it is to buy a house, even if you're just writing a check for it. So, you know, building houses and whole subdivisions of houses allows them to really scale up. And the reason they're doing that now more than ever is because the pandemic has really put a shine on spacious suburban living, right? A lot of people who are, you know, living in a city and they say, you know, well, we were going to move out to the suburbs and buy a house and start a family, or our kids would be school aged. So we were going to buy in a few years. But now, you know, the city's not looking so great right now. It's not the same sort of place to live. It might take some time to recover. Interest rates are at an all-time low. Let's go house hunting. So that's why we're seeing this sort of move into the suburbs. And of course, you know, some people are finding they can't afford it. But hey, look, here's a brand new house. We can be the first to move in. We're just going to be renting. We're going to be paying some investor's mortgage rather than our own.
Now, the thought for at least middle class America for decades now has been that equity in the house is how you store up wealth to maybe send your kid to college. Obviously, the Great Recession, as you were saying earlier, shook that up for people. But is there a concern that if home buying is less of an option, if home renting is more and more the way of the future, are we losing something here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Americans, you know, at least in the last like half century or so, since World War II, say, have not been great savers. And they have largely, the middle class has kept pace and holding on to their share of like sort of the pie, the overall American wealth, not because they're earning any more money than they would have adjusted for inflation. It's about the same, but their homes have risen in value. And that's where most middle-class families earn their wealth and, you know, pay for, you know, you get the starter home, you sell it, you get a bigger home, then you downsize and you take the equity out, and that sort of funds your retirement. That system is threatened by this because, one, you don't have people sort of getting on that escalator of earning equity and sort of stashing away, sort of saving by accident with every monthly mortgage check. You have that problem. And on the other end, you have people at the top of that ladder or that escalator who have the big house and are waiting for sort of the next generation to come and buy them out at a price that they're hoping will be much more than they paid to fund their, you know, retirement or, you know, medical care, whatever they need at the end of their lives. And they might not be able to do that because they didn't get on that escalator to earn the money to get up to that. So it really does call into question and maybe threaten that sort of home as a piggy bank system that we've set up in America for the middle class.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Dezember is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us to look at a boom in the rental single-family housing market. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, Kate's guest shares financial advice with a focus on the millennial generation and the economic challenges, including some we've just talked about, that they've faced from the Great Recession and now the pandemic. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Americans' trust in Congress, big business, and other institutions has gone down over the years, but the U.S. military has reversed that trend. We'll find out how and talk about how other groups could maybe regain the public trust by learning from the military. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.